Hello, everyone. My name is Peter Gibeon. I'm in the English department at McGill, and my job for today is an easy one. It's to welcome all of you in surprising numbers to today's lecture, and to welcome today's speaker, Pericles Lewis, on his return to McGill and the McGill campus. Today's lecture kicks off the Provost's Conference, Academic Freedom, Challenges and Opportunities, to be held tomorrow afternoon in Redpath Hall, not Redpath Museum. The hall is directly pretty much across the street, not the museum, which is further inside the quadrangle. Registration opens at 12 noon. The program starts at 12:30. The conference will feature a range of panels and presentations by distinguished speakers from both inside and outside of McGill. And then at the end of the afternoon, following the last panel session, conference attendees will be invited to participate in discussions about how academic freedom does, can, or could work here at McGill. Small groups will tackle aspects of this crucial, complex topic and report back to the whole assembly. So I hope you'll be able to join us for what promises to be a dynamic and exciting event. But let me turn our attention now to today's introductory lecture by Pericles Lewis. Over the years, McGill's Department of English has produced a long list of impressive graduates who have gone on to successful careers, not only in academia, but also in theater, film, journalism, publishing, and various other fields. Today, I am delighted to have the opportunity to welcome one of our distinguished alums, Pericles Lewis, back to McGill. I still have vivid memories of Pericles when he was a student here. We were calculating about 20 years ago. But who's counting? He stood out amongst his peers for his omnivorous, that's the word that comes to mind, omnivorous intellectual curiosity and intellectual ambition. I remember with great pleasure long chats with Pericles about his readings and about his grad school plans, about potential mentors who might prove to be good matches for him at the various schools that I had been to and that I knew about. As it turned out, we would share a remarkable number of experiences of different schools and different academic cultures across North America. After he graduated from McGill, Pericles went to my graduate school alma mater, Stanford University, where he completed his PhD in literature in 1997. The following year, he joined the faculty at my undergraduate alma mater, Yale, where he emerged as a leading figure in the study of literary modernism. Pericles is the author of three books, Modernism, Nationalism, and the Novel, The Cambridge Introduction to Modernism, and most recently, Religious Experience and the Modernist Novel. He's also the editor of the Cambridge Companion to European Modernism and the 20th Century editor for the Norton Anthology of World Literature and the Norton Anthology of Western Literature, as well as a founding editor of the Modernism Lab, an innovative digital humanities site dedicated to collaborative research on the roots of literary modernism as it emerged out of a context of social, political, and existential ferment. Pericles is here today, however, not to talk about literature specifically, but to talk more generally about academic freedom and academic freedom abroad, the challenges of establishing a liberal arts college in Singapore, from the vantage point of his role as founding president and professor of humanities at Yale's new campus known as Yale NUS College, a residential liberal arts college founded jointly by Yale University and the National University of Singapore, due to open in 2013. The presidency of Yale NUS, Singapore's first liberal arts college, will give Pericles, as he says, an exceptional opportunity to help shape a distinctive educational venture from the ground up. But he is well aware that the international, cross-cultural nature of this venture may also raise fundamental questions about and challenges to traditional notions of the culture of liberal education, of freedom of speech and expression, of academic freedom. How will the values and ideals of academic freedom function in a context of vastly different social, economic, and cultural traditions? How will a liberal arts college protect the academic freedom of its faculty members and its students in an environment where freedoms of speech and assembly are defined differently? Pericles will talk today about his plans for Yale and US and about his advocacy for a liberal arts and sciences education that encourages critical thinking within the context of a residential learning community. So please join me in welcoming one of our former students, of whom both I and McGill are extraordinarily proud, Pericles Lewis, speaking today. His title is Academic Freedom Abroad, Establishing a Liberal Arts College in Singapore. Pericles.
Thanks, Peter. It's a funny experience. It's actually 22 years, so half my life since I graduated from McGill. And I've been back to Montreal a few times, and I've been on the McGill campus, but this is my first time addressing some of my former teachers. So one always has a little anxiety in that situation. McGill was a great home for me. I was talking with David Hensley, who was my senior essay advisor back in 1990, about the fact that in those days there was a three-year degree if you'd gone to high school in Ontario, as I had. So those 3 years were really important for me, both the intellectual exposure in the English department, which led to my future career, and my involvement with various McGill activities, the McGill Debating Society, McGill Nightline, these kinds of things, which created a kind of community that was very important for me. So it's just an honor to be back here and speaking to all of you. And I'd like to apologize for the fact that I have to miss tomorrow's conference. I had originally hoped to be there, and then there was a change in the schedule of a meeting I had to attend back in New Haven. So I really apologize for that, and that's entirely my fault for not having understood the nature of my schedule better, but this is something I'm just getting used to. It's my 89th day as president of Yale NUS College, which in a way, well, it exists, but it doesn't yet have students, so you know, it's one of those colleges that doesn't quite exist yet. But after 90 days, I've discovered some of the challenges of this kind of position. So as to my talk, the second half is going to be about establishing a liberal arts college in Singapore. The first half is basically about the concept of academic freedom. I don't claim any real expertise. I haven't studied the matter as extensively as some of you have. But obviously, in practice, I'm involved in trying to negotiate and understand what are the possibilities for academic freedom, what are the limits, how do we ensure academic freedom in our activities, particularly abroad. So I'll start with the two concepts of academic freedom. There are obviously many intermediate ones, but I'm just going to choose two sort of ideal types. But start by asking, what is the purpose of education? A very broad question. At one level, we can think of it in terms of technical training. Even an English department can train people in certain techniques, close reading or historical analysis or what have you. And to some extent, obviously more technical subjects, it's more obvious that the training and technique may be a central part of what an education is about. But I think that all of us probably in this room would agree that beyond technical training, beyond even the creation of knowledge, which is something that the great universities are in the business of doing, and certainly beyond preparing students for life in the global economy or something like that, we are also preparing students for life in a much broader sense, getting them ready to be engaged citizens, getting them ready to lead what the philosophers call a good life, a responsible life, to be participants not just in the global economy but in society and in communities, and to live well in the most serious sense of living well. And in thinking about this new liberal arts college that Yale and the National University of Singapore are establishing in Singapore. And I should clarify that Yale NUS is not a branch campus of Yale. It's an autonomous institution that's governed jointly by Yale and NUS. It will be in Singapore. And it has a liberal arts curriculum that is modeled to a large extent on the way American liberal arts education works. A four-year curriculum, students don't choose their majors the day that they arrive on campus or before they arrive on campus. They explore a wide range of materials from across the humanities, social sciences, and sciences before delving into a major, and so on. In thinking about what we wanted to offer students at this new college, we asked ourselves, what does a student need to learn to lead a responsible life in this century? And that means, of course, learning skills and abilities to analyze. It means learning things that we've taught in literature and humanities departments for a long time, ethics, understanding political thought, and so forth. It also has, when we talk about this century, there are certain particular challenges. How do you analyze large amounts of data? What do you do with the global political situation and the way that it impacts global political or economic situation impacts the environment, for example, would be an appropriate subject of study in a liberal arts education. More broadly, I think, as Peter alluded to in thinking about a community of learning, I think that what happens in a good undergraduate education, and particularly in the residential liberal arts colleges on which Yale-NUS is modeled, is that students create what I think of as a lively civil society that is that operates in parallel to the official curriculum. So we're not just offering, not only are we not just offering technical education and not just offering skills or abilities that you can learn in the classroom, but we're also trying to create a community in which people interact with one another, think critically, learn citizenship and leadership skills. And one of the things that the American liberal arts education, drawing on Oxford and Cambridge, and we have some variants of this in Canada too, of course, has done very effectively is to have those organizations and those opportunities for leadership and for developing your talents and for working closely with other people be formative of students' character. And I think that part of what we're aiming for is to make an education that's more than just about the transmission of technical skills, the creation of knowledge, but that's also about the development of character. So how does this relate to the two concepts of academic freedom? I'll start by quoting my colleague David Bromwich in a recent essay called Academic Freedom and Its Opponents, who is concerned primarily with incursions, what he sees as incursions on academic freedom of professors in the U.S., and another example is in Israel, where political statements made outside the classroom, mostly outside the classroom, were held against a professor because they were seen as going beyond the scope of that professor's academic freedom. And what Bromwich says is that the limits of academic freedom should not be narrower than the limits of intellectual freedom. It is the right of the scholar to think, write, and speak whatever he or she wants to think, write, and speak. The way to up, and that's the beginning of the essay, and the end of the essay is that the way to uphold the principle of academic freedom is simply to treat it as part of the ordinary freedom that is the birthright of citizens in a democracy. Now, having spoken about liberal arts education, I think that it's important to recognize that freedom is central to the notion of the liberal arts. Going back to the Romans, essentially, liberal arts is what is important for a free person to know. And one of the reasons that the liberal arts education had the purchase it did in the 19th century in the United States, when many of the leading liberal arts colleges were founded, was the idea that a new republic also needed to train its people, its young people, for freedom. And I think this interacts pretty closely with what Bromwich says here. It's important to me, and it's important to Yale, and I would add that it's important to our academic partners in Singapore to guarantee the academic freedom of participants at Yale-NUS College, and that means faculty and students, and staff for that matter. And in that vein, I understand academic freedom quite broadly. I think of it in the context of Amartya Sen's notion of human development as an expansion of freedom and fulfillment of human capabilities. That is to say, this is a notion of freedom that's quite broad-ranging and that includes not only, obviously, in two concepts of freedom, I'm referring to Isaiah Berlin's essay, not only kind of the negative freedom from constraint, but also positive freedoms that are developed, that involve the development of capabilities. So in the case of Bromwich's definition, which refers specifically to the birthright of citizens in a democracy, The question would be, how does this species of academic freedom, if academic freedom is essentially a species of political freedom, how do you guarantee academic freedom in a context in which the political freedoms available are quite different, with different conceptions of what political freedoms are appropriate? And I'll get into some of the details of that in a moment. On the other hand, I'll offer another colleague of mine who's the dean of the Yale Law School, Robert Post's definition of academic freedom. Post writes that academic freedom defines the sphere of the university as independent from the control of external forces, extends to the creation of professional knowledge, which is to say, of disciplinary knowledge. It does not safeguard mere amateurs who wish to contribute to the political development of the nation. What I find difficult about this formulation is the notion that contributing to the political development of the nation is something done by mere amateurs. The point that Post is making is that not every subject for discussion in a classroom is defended by academic freedom, because if it's not part of your area of expertise, it's really some other kind of freedom other than academic freedom that allows you to say it. And I'll get in, I'm sort of not eager in a way to get into a bunch of specific cases, but in terms of principles, I'll get into a couple of principles in more detail in a moment. But I think this reflects a more restricted notion of academic freedom that essentially says academic freedom is closely aligned with your area of expertise. I see Carrie Nelson here, and I can't help but say that often people cite the AAUP statement of 1915 in this regard, and my understanding of the nature of the AAUP statement of 1915, and I'll leave it to him tomorrow or in the question period to talk about it, that is that it was in a somewhat defensive position in a place where the academy was under attack, and so that in order to defend what academic freedom there was, one said, well, this is all related to expertise, and defined it fairly narrowly, but that I take it the AAUP defends a much broader conception of academic freedom than the version identified here by Post. I said two types of academic freedom, but here is a more extreme version of Post's position, almost a parody of it. Fish, whom I first encountered in David Hensley's literary criticism class 23 years ago, is always fun to read because he always exaggerates a great deal, and one wonders if it's just for effect, but he does often believe his exaggerations. So here he says, the moment a teacher tries to promote a political or social agenda, and so far you might think, oh, I can see that this is mold the character of students, and then you start to worry, produce civic virtue, or institute a regime of tolerance, he or she has stepped away from the imminent rationality of the enterprise and performed an action in relation to which there is no academic freedom protection because there's nothing academic going on. Now, it's fair enough to me to say that a teacher should not undertake a political campaign in the classroom. And I'll say now what I was going to wait and say in a moment, which is that I arrived in the United States 22 years ago, a Canadian citizen. I'd spent my entire life up until then in Canada. And I did not feel, at first I had the Canadian instinct, you'll pardon me as fellow citizens, to just say, oh, this everything is so terrible in the United States, you know, it's so. And then, you know, I realized that it might not behoove me when I was coming to a new country to study in there, find graduate schools and so on, to assume that I was superior to them in my ability to understand their political system. It also was a sort of a surprising thing to realize that how diverse the political situation in the U.S. is, because after 10 years of Republican rule, there was the Canadian impression that only Republicans lived in the United States, or, you know, there was just a misunderstanding of the nature of what the political culture of the United States was. I was young, but anyway, I was conscious and have been conscious about not telling Americans how they should run their political system. I'm a little more active now that I'm also a U.S. citizen. And I'm also conscious of not coming here and telling you how you should develop academic freedom. But I will draw a little parallel to what I've seen of the debates about academic freedom in Canada. But what I'll say about Fish is that while I think it's fair enough to say that a teacher should not be handing out leaflets for his or her political party in the classroom, the idea that education has nothing to do with character or encouraging tolerance or civic virtue is to me a very limited notion of what higher education is about. It's so research-driven as to ignore a good part of our educational mission. And even in a fairly technical subject, I mentioned political thought or literature which deals with all kinds of human values, but even a fairly technical subject such as computer science or biology, there are ethical dimensions that I don't think a faculty member should ignore. That doesn't mean that you should insist that every student in your classroom shares your ethical views, but Fish is not only saying that we shouldn't impose our views on students, but he even says we should not try to institute a regime of tolerance. And yet it seems to me that at some level a regime of tolerance is necessary for the classroom to exist. So to properly understand academic freedom, I think to narrowly understand it as only the ability to lecture on one's own research topic, for example, would deprive us of a lot of the real meaning of academic freedom and a lot of the real purpose of our educational institutions. Okay, so now this is when I was going to give the disclaimer. I do follow Canadian politics very closely, but I'm afraid I haven't followed the debate about academic freedom in Canada closely enough to have any expertise at all, so I welcome people correcting me later on. But I will say, from the materials that were sent to me, the AUCC has proposed the following statement, made the following statement. Academic freedom is the freedom to teach and conduct research in an academic environment. Unlike the broader concept of freedom of speech, academic freedom must be based on institutional integrity, rigorous standards for inquiry, and institutional autonomy, which allows universities to set their research and educational priorities. And I also read the response on the part of the CAUT. I think my question about this statement, which those of you here would know better than I the context and so on, is that it seems to leave open the question of whether academic freedom is a species of freedom of speech, which I would think it is. And it suggests that freedom of speech in the classroom or in academic settings may be more constrained than freedom of speech in Canada in general, right? And again, going back to the notion of democracy, obviously the constraints on freedom of speech are somewhat different in Canada than they are in the United States. American public institutions are bound by the First Amendment. Canadian public institutions don't seem to be bound in the same way by the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. American private institutions have the ability to institute speech codes that public institutions can't. This is a very complex field on which I don't know much more than the average reader of, you know, the Chronicle of Higher Education and Inside Higher Education and that kind of thing, so I don't want to claim any expertise about it. CAUT's response, AUCC is correct that academic freedom is a professional right, but your statement fails to acknowledge any of the nuance that is now commonplace. Profession is both the basis for academic freedom, but can be a source of its abuse. English professors, I'm not citing this as a good example of sort of parallelism of grammatical construction, but anyway. Hence, the need to understand professional standards as heuristic devices that themselves are always contested. None of this subtlety appears in the AUCC statement, leaving a rigid notion of professional standards of the relevant discipline that could countenance repression of academic freedom for ideas at the margin or ideas that are critical of the mainstream. I don't know to what extent this is actually an active problem in Canadian universities, to what extent this is a question of trying to work out principles in the abstract, or what political forces motivated either the CAUT or the AUCC to make these statements. But I'll just observe that the CAUT critique shares the concern raised in the Bromwich piece, which I quoted first, that if academic freedom is interpreted too narrowly, it might actually reduce the freedom of academics by limiting their freedom to speak about public matters, and that would be problematic. So famously, as Larry Summers discovered, a university or college president gives up academic freedom. And as I mentioned, this is day 89. So I'm a new president, and I still feel a lot like a faculty member. So I'll be diplomatic and maybe not too diplomatic. I think there are reasonable and unreasonable uses of classroom time, and in the classroom context, you should obey standards of professional and professional expectations. This is sort of just my gut view of things. For example, you should actually teach your subject. You should not mark down a student for having different political opinions than yourself, and so forth. And to that extent, as I already indicated, I agree with Fish. But surely part of educational life is encouraging discussion of even controversial topics. And the notion that we can only discuss such topics in the classroom if we are experts in them seems potentially chilling. In a way, there's almost the fact that I am definitely not an expert on academic freedom, and yet I'm asked to speak to you about academic freedom. Well, you know. Indeed, I think most of us would agree that a successful academic climate depends on an atmosphere of tolerance, and thus that establishing tolerance in the classroom is not only not at odds with academic freedom, but is to some extent essential to the full exercise of academic freedom. Certainly also, academics do not give up their freedom to speak on public matters outside the classroom just because they become academics. I've always been struck by Kant's argument in What is Enlightenment, that while in our private capacities as employees, we are responsible to our employers, including when that employer is the government or a public university, we should all be equally free to discuss public matters in our capacity as citizens, and one doesn't give up that capacity by virtue of taking on a government position. The striking thing about Kant here is that the notion of public and private might seem a little bit counterintuitive. That is to say, the private is not what you do in the sphere of the living room or something like that. The private is what you do in your capacity as a wage-earning person, and you have to do what your employer tells you. The public is what you do in your capacity as a citizen, and the question is all about, is your capacity as a citizen in some way constrained by the limits of academic freedom? And I would think not. By analogy, I would think that while there are reasonable limits to the use of classroom time or university facilities or university letterhead to pursue particular political ends, I don't think that there should be any restriction on the ability of a faculty member to say what he or she likes outside the classroom about matters of public import, including, of course, matters about the administration of the college or university where he or she works. I do think it's important that the speaker should, when speaking for him or herself, should probably make it clear that they're not speaking for the institution, but they're speaking for themselves. I think academic freedom should be construed broadly when it comes to a faculty member's right to talk about any subject in the classroom, as long as the instructor does not abuse his or her authority over the students. And that would be my answer to Post's claim that, you know, amateurs trying to make contributions to the political freedom of the nation. Yes, there are cases, undoubtedly, although they are, I think, sometimes exaggerated in the media, of people using the classroom as a pulpit to just try and force people to vote the way they want them to vote or to see a political issue the way they want them to. But that's not what the majority of classroom discussions of political life is like, nor is it what we should aim for. So it leaves open the question, which is, I think, what I was actually asked to talk about, of what freedoms are available in a society with very different conceptions of democracy than ours. Singapore has a democratic constitution, but in some respects it's not a liberal democracy. It has much more restricted notions of free speech and assembly than we do in Canada or than we do in the United States. There is the interesting situation, which this audience will understand maybe better than some audiences in New Haven, that some of the laws are left over from the colonial period, which only ended in 1965 in Singapore. And you will often find Singaporeans saying, why shouldn't we have these laws when you know, you guys, when the British ruled Singapore, you had these laws, and, you know, why are you blaming us for not living up to what you do now, and so on. And I understand that reaction on the part of Singaporeans to the feeling that they're being lectured by former colonial powers. So I've been involved in founding a new college in Singapore, and it is a liberal arts college dedicated to free and open inquiry. An essential part of such an undertaking is a broad guarantee of academic freedom. I'd like to start talking about the college by reading this interesting comment from the Deputy Prime Minister Tharman, who was the Minister of Education a few years back and who pursued the idea of having liberal arts education as part of what happens in Singapore. Singapore has a very British-based system, not unlike what we had in Canada about 50 years ago, where you choose your major before you go in. Law is an undergraduate degree, medicine is an undergraduate degree. The idea of breadth of study has not been particularly encouraged. And over the last couple of decades, they've moved more towards that. They've moved towards more active learning in the classroom, critical thinking, seminar-based discussion. It's also a resource question. If lecturers get big enough, you know, there's a point beyond which active discussion in the classroom is just not going to happen. And so it's very resource-intensive, obviously, to have small classroom discussions, and that's what they're investing in with Yale and US College. So, again, I'm conscious of being a dual citizen who grew up in Canada speaking to a mostly Canadian audience about America as seen from Singapore. But we both have meritocracies. Yours is a talent meritocracy. Ours is an exam meritocracy. We know how to train people to take exams. You know how to use people's talents to the fullest. Both are important, but there are some parts of the intellect that we are not able to test well, like creativity, curiosity, a sense of adventure, ambition. Most of all, America has a culture of learning that challenges conventional wisdom, even if it means challenging authority. These are the areas where Singapore must learn from America. So an essential part of such an undertaking is a broad guarantee of academic freedom. Both my own inquiries and those undertaken by Yale officials in advance of arriving at this agreement suggest a high level of academic freedom at the National University of Singapore, and particularly that these freedoms have grown over the past decade since the university has been formally autonomous and as restrictions on speech and journalism have in general been liberalized. And I'm not going to give you a whole history of contemporary Singapore except to say that there were the most open elections that had ever happened in which the governing party, those remaining in power, had its majority reduced last year, and that there was a very live blogosphere and internet discussion about political that created a kind of civil society that in the past would have been much more constrained. This is obviously something that's in the process of changing, and those who think that Yale shouldn't be spending its time and energies in Singapore will often say, well, why don't you wait until the change happens and then we can go have a liberal arts college in Singapore. I don't think our goal in setting up a liberal arts college in Singapore is to accelerate or change or anything, change in Singaporean politics. But I do think that the Singaporean political situation is such that there is a potential for a liberal arts college to be very successful there. There are the, as I'll talk about in a moment, the correct guarantees for academic freedom to make that possible, and that we are contributing to the development of a society that is in rapid transition. And not that I'm going to go and tell them how to run their government, but our students are going to be the ones who are making decisions in the future. And so I feel that this engagement is appropriate in all of those ways. So despite our general exploration of the situation of academic freedom in Singapore, which is generally, you know, for the most part, pretty positive in terms of what we found, nonetheless, in arranging an agreement with the National University of Singapore, we have built specific protections built into the agreement, including non-discrimination policies that protect sexual minorities and a specific policy on academic freedom. So the question is, can you have academic freedom where other freedoms are more constrained? In such contexts, academic freedom offers, I think, Bromwich talks about academic freedom as an extension of the natural birthright of citizens in a democracy. But I think that academic freedom can also offer something more than that, which is an extra type of protection beyond the standard legal protections that are enjoyed by every citizen in a particular society, where by accord a certain additional type of freedom is guaranteed to academic research and study. And I also think that there's a penumbra around that area of study, as I talked about the importance of clubs, societies, groups on campus, and so on. I think it's very important that the freedom is not just for purely academic discussion in the classroom, but for broad exercise of freedoms on campus. That said, when you're operating a college in any given country, you know, that does not give you license to promise anybody that they can break the laws of the country or subject to the laws of the country that you're in. The Singaporean situation is one in which there's a great deal of discretion in the use of laws, which obviously can have people have questioned that, but it also means that agreements of protecting academic freedom and so on are within the power of the appropriate ministries, even if in some areas political freedoms are much more restricted than they will be in the college. So when I was first named as president, I spoke directly in my opening press conference about the importance of academic freedom, and I said, sorry to quote myself, the liberal arts are closely aligned with freedom, the freedom to pursue intellectual questions wherever scholarship takes us, and the freedom to debate issues of current concern. And I expanded upon this notion in the press conference afterwards, and I was praised in the press, which, you know, you enjoy it the first time it happens. A couple of months later, I was asked about Singapore's laws on freedom of assembly, and my comments were inaccurately summarized in the Wall Street Journal and also in the Globe and Mail, it turned out. And I was then condemned in the press and by Human Rights Watch, so you don't enjoy it as much the second time around. Obviously, in a venture like this, there is some distinction between the political freedoms that are generally available in the society and the academic freedoms that are on campus. But I think that we need to understand those academic freedoms in a broad sense. And so to the extent that I've learned something from this first 89 days and so on, it's that we have to be careful to define those freedoms well in advance. We can't imagine what every potential circumstance is. and we have to be ready to, you know, guarantee those. And if you're going to, I think that there is a great place for international education and for these, for ventures of the kind of Yale NUS College, in making available a kind of education that's not currently available in Asia. We have great demand for it because it's something that's not available there. The number of Singaporeans, for example, who come to North America or to Britain or to Australia for an education because they can't get, because the options that are available to them in Singapore are of a certain type, who now are interested in staying in Singapore, or people in other parts of Asia who are interested in coming to Singapore to have the access to the kind of education that in the past you had to go to the United States for. So I think that's, all of that speaks to the importance of the project, but I do think it's important to guarantee appropriate freedoms when this happens. So this is our policy on academic freedom. The college upholds the principles of academic freedom and open inquiry, essential core values in higher education of the highest caliber. Faculty and students in the college will be free to conduct scholarship and research and publish the results and to teach in the classroom and express themselves on campus, bearing in mind the need to act in accordance with accepted scholarly and professional standards and the regulations of the college. Obviously, the last clause is the one that you want to interpret, and it gets into the CAUT versus AUCC area, and we could talk about that some more. This is from the mission statement of Yale NUS College. We educate citizens, which was one of the things we did this summer with the new faculty. We have 40 new faculty and about the same number of staff. We actually have already admitted some students. And we had a number of sessions with the faculty and staff to identify what are key things to emphasize in our mission statement. And one of them, very strongly felt by faculty and staff, Singaporean and non-Singaporean, was the free exchange of ideas. So we educate citizens of the world and uphold the principles of free exchange of ideas, pluralism, and respect for diversity. And in framing our faculty handbook, our student handbook, our staff handbook, we are keeping these principles, you know, front and center. So what are the issues that, I was going to say sort of at the end before turning to these issues, any such endeavor is a balancing act between local political traditions and laws and broad principles of open debate and free speech and assembly. In our case, we're actively cooperating with our partner, the National University of Singapore, which has itself been reviewing its policies to encourage just such liberties on campus. So we're at a time of change, and we're, you know, interestingly part of that change. What are the issues? Obviously, the issue of the relationship between academic freedom and political freedom. Where does one stop and the next one begin? I would argue for a broad definition of academic freedom that's pretty closely interacts with political freedom. The importance of diversity of views and the ability for people to express a diversity of views on campus, for example, invited speakers. I think that in going into international ventures in particular, there's an importance to negotiating strong guarantees before you get into these partnerships to make sure that your values, I don't want to suggest that there are sort of one set of values that are all American or North American and another set of values that are all Asian. I don't think that's true. But there are values associated with the academic. I'm not talking about even really broad values of democracy or anything like that. I'm talking about the values associated with the academic enterprise that I've spoken about already, that those need to be guaranteed if the academic enterprise is going to succeed. It's important to create a climate of free inquiry on campus, and that's something that is not just a matter of laws and regulations and the faculty handbook, but also of living it. Respect for cultural differences. I do think it's important to recognize that standing on a soapbox in New Haven and saying we don't like the way you do things over there is not always the most effective way to communicate across cultures. And the value of engagement. I think there's obviously a debate in the United States. I understand there's some debate in Canada too about international projects of the kind that I'm involved in. Mine turns out to be one of the more prominent ones. Obviously, NYU has even more elaborate sort of global network of universities that it's set up. And I understand the concerns and of critics who say, "Why do this? You're compromising your values and so on." I don't see it that way. I see the engagement with, well, you saw the quotation from Deputy Prime Minister Tharman, the engagement with other societies who are eager to learn from what, in this particular case, American liberal arts education has to offer, who are eager to create a partnership. And I'll say just briefly about our partnership that we are particularly not trying to export the Yale curriculum. We're creating a new curriculum that takes account of the Asian location, that pays some attention to, you know, to Asian cultures, to issues like, for example, environments. We have an expert on tsunamis, and some of what we're doing in environmental studies is very specific to Southeast Asia. So it takes account of its context, of its cultures, and so on. None of that is to say give up academic freedom or anything like that, but to say that in a particular cultural context, the way that academic freedom plays out may vary somewhat. But more importantly than that, I think that the broad principles of open inquiry, free inquiry, discussion, debate, critical thinking have to be at the center of any such engagement. And I really don't think that the National University of Singapore would be inviting us into this partnership if they didn't feel the same way, and for that matter, the Singapore Ministry of Education. So I feel that any such engagement should uphold the values of academic freedom, and that, of course, there are many complexities having to do with the line between academic freedom and political freedoms that, you know, I'd be happy to discuss with you all. So I don't want to take a position, as you can tell, on CAUT versus AUCC or what your policy on academic freedom should be or anything like that, except to say that I, in a broad sense, I would say that we're better off with a broad conception of academic freedom, one that recognizes its congruity with political freedom. And thinking back to the reference to the Amartya Sen that I think I mentioned at the beginning, the idea of that part of what education is about is the broad expansion of human freedoms, and we have to understand our mission broadly and not narrowly. Thank you. That last line was what I just said, and then this is a drawing of what our campus will look like in 2.5 years, all construction teams and so on willing. Do we share a mic?
I think we'll share a mic for a moment. It's maybe I should come over. It's my pleasure to serve as moderator for the discussion that follows Pericles Lewis's presentation. I want to thank you for such a stimulating, far-reaching, and a nuanced discussion of academic freedom. It seems it very nicely opens up to not just the particular situation of the new college, but many of the issues that we're going to be discussing tomorrow. Before I open it up, let me take the privilege of the mic and ask a question myself. We have at McGill, and there are scholars from North America and Europe all over the world working. And there are people working in North Korea. There are people working in Burma. You name the repressive government, there are scholars working there. And many of us have felt that this is important, that scholars be engaged in places where, in fact, the political conditions are far more repressive than those that we enjoy. I've worked myself for years in Kenya. Now, Kenya is a much more positive place in terms of the freedom of speech, et cetera, than it was just a few years ago. And the scholars all were quite skittish. They were very careful where they could speak, and they're very protective of the people they worked with in terms of jeopardizing them. So I'm curious if I could pose the question to you, and I'll see this mic. I think okay. You should be speaking from this mic. Can you contrast the situation of researchers and scholars who are working in diverse parts of the world where academic freedom is not secured, and yet there is an importance and in some ways a mandate for them to work in those challenged areas, and the situation where you're establishing a college that will be rooted in a certain place and over many, many years interact with the political culture of that place?
Sure, thank you. Well, I suppose the situation of this individual scholar who's doing research in a neoliberal regime is somewhat distinct in that presumably the scholar, if necessary, can hightail it out of there to the relative safety of the next door country or further away. I think, you know, you're probably all at least somewhat aware of the fact that some of my colleagues at Yale are less than happy about Yale NUS College. I would say that if you've just read the newspapers, you would get the impression that there were a whole lot of very, very unhappy people, but if you speak to them over a cup of coffee and so on, there seem to be fewer and they seem to be less unhappy than the newspaper suggests, but maybe that's just, you know, my optimism. I think the reason for concern is that if you set up an ongoing operation somewhere, obviously there are a lot of risks. There are reputational risks. You could, you know, you could damage the Yale name, the McGill name. There are political risks. You don't know what's going to happen in a country in 5 or 10 years and what the implications are going to be for that. I think, without going into a lot of details of the agreement and so on, I think that that, you know, my bosses, the people who put me in this job, did a pretty good job of trying to protect against a lot of those risks in setting up the agreements. But you can't control every risk, you know, and we don't know how the political situation will develop in Singapore. To date, the signs are generally positive. That's, you know, that's my view as somebody who has been to Singapore on 10 occasions, but 9 of them are in the last year, and only one of them was about 19 years ago. I do have colleagues who spent more time in Singapore 20 years ago, and they tend to be a lot more pessimistic. But when you talk to the younger people in Singapore, and when you talk to younger people who study Singapore, I think there's a general feeling of optimism about this whole area of freedoms that that, you know, that I tend to share. But any new venture is inherently risky, and I would admit that this one carries more risk than most of the things that most universities do. I mean, most universities are very cautious, and probably with good reason, but really interesting initiatives are the riskier ones. And in fact, when I thought about becoming president, I'm digressing into autobiography, but when I thought about going and doing this job, some people say, are you crazy, you know? But you're only going to do something interesting if you take a risk once in a while, and I feel that this is a risk worth taking because the possibility of offering a new model of liberal arts education that will really shape education in Asia, which is a place where more and more people are going to university, I think that there's a real, you know, real benefits that can be had, and that's what I was trying to articulate by referring to Sen's notions of expanding freedoms.
Thank you very much. Can I open up the floor to questions and brief comments, if you could?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Karen Nelson. I'm from which department? I'm from the U.S. Department of the University of Illinois, but I've also been president of the National Agency for some years, including June 18th, which means that my 200 emails a day have been vastly diminished.
To 190 or something like that.
I still get quite a few, not quite that much. I've been once faculty at Yale, got word of that when I was both being in the city at the same time. I've been getting a lot of emails from them the last few days. I guess they would be from discontented members of the faculty. And one of their concerns, I think, is that some of the repressive culture, like Singapore, functions by self-censorship. People try to decide what kind of political speech is safe, what they can get away with, and of course, you never really know exactly. And so you self-censor often more than you need to. And I think there are two concerns related to that. One is that it's going to be very hard once you start talking about critical thinking at your institution, for that critical thinking not to embrace critical about the same thing,
sure, of course.
About the political system, about the freedoms.
Yeah.
And, you know, my university has a history of relations with Singapore. In some ways, parallel, because the administration just announced certain freedoms. It involved faculty in elaborate discussion, much as I think Yale really didn't. And we ran into some problems along the way, one of which was that Singapore authorities were very unhappy about the University of Illinois student website. It's very critical of society mm-hmm. and strongly urged the administration to get it shut down, mm-hmm. which my administration, which wasn't really recommending these things, mm-hmm. proceeded to do. Mm-hmm. Terrorized the graduate students and shut it down. The faculty and tried to defend the students, but then they were terrified and couldn't back up. So the Singapore authorities aren't just resistant to political administration. Mm-hmm. They're also concerned about certain kinds of political speech. And your canvas, if you run out of critical thinking, mm-hmm. Yale faculty are going to be what Yale faculty are. Mm-hmm. Those issues are going to come up. Mm-hmm. Singapore authorities retain the right to surveil the campus mm-hmm. and websites of campus mm-hmm. activity at a level much beyond what we're mm-hmm. accustomed to in the United States. I think you're going to run into trouble. Mm-hmm. And you're already, unwilling to become mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. for neoliberalism, mm-hmm. disingenuous relationship to mm-hmm. around the world, I think we're going to get to the problem.
Okay. Well, I don't think there's anything disingenuous about it, A. And B, just going back to the earlier point, and then I'll answer the substantive point, I can imagine some of my colleagues who would have written to you, and I understand where you're coming from, but the claim that the administration just foisted this on the faculty without any discussion is something that you hear repeated by people who are critical of it, but there was a year of discussion. The problem that faculty have is that the Yale College faculty wasn't asked to vote on it. You know, so it's a slightly more complicated matter than the administration announced it without any consultation, just on that point. Discussions in New Haven, they've been very open. You know, the question about self-censorship is a real one, there's no doubt. And one of the things that I mentioned here is creating a climate of free inquiry. I think it's very important that on a campus people feel, you know, completely free to have open discussions. I think in reality we know that self-censorship takes place everywhere, and undoubtedly it's worse if you're worried that somebody's looking over your shoulder and so on. So I think that to succeed, we need to make people in our college feel safe about having open discussions that are critical about the government and so on. Your story is not amazing to me or anything like that. I don't doubt it about what happened at Illinois. There's been pretty open criticism of Singapore in the Yale Daily News and in among colleagues and so on. And I guess I can kind of remember maybe having an exchange with somebody where I said I didn't really like what they'd said about me. They'd said just something nasty about me. That was more of a personal, like, I was offended rather than how dare you say that the Singaporean government isn't democratic enough or something like that. That's the closest I can imagine to that happening, because we've had a very robust and open debate, and I would be very surprised to hear any of my colleagues say otherwise. When it comes to what happens in Singapore, with the blogosphere and so on, there is much more open criticism of the government now than there was 2 or 3 years ago. And some of that takes place in student publications on the NUS campus. When it comes to, for example, criticism of the government policy on capital punishment or government, you know, various other policies, democratization, so on, a lot of that takes place already in NUS departments. In the law school, I've heard it said that, you know, you're considered terribly naive if you support the governing party, and that nobody does. In the sociology department, there are people having very open courses they're very critical of. So, you know, we've looked at these examples. I'm sure that doesn't mean there is no self-censorship. I'm sure that there are people who do self-censor. But I've met a lot of people who don't, and who see the opportunity for expansion. And I think if we waited, this is what I did say in New Haven at one point, if we waited until we found a political culture that was perfectly to our liking. We would only ever open a liberal arts college, excuse this, my McGill friends, in Toronto, but Toronto doesn't need us to open a liberal arts college there. I mean, yes, we could open it here in Montreal. I use it as an example because it's my hometown. But right. It's so that narrowness is not actually inherent in the AAUP, but Bromwich also quotes the AAUP one to suggest that it's too constrained, so that's where I came up with that, but that may be wrong. So, thanks.
Thank you. That's my thought.
Thank you, Professor Lewis, for the here for the Yale model.
Sure.
I'm interested in your division between the concept of human rights and mm-hmm. academic freedom. Mm-hmm. As if there are two spheres, or as if one does not fall within the other. And you mentioned Marcus Sen, mm-hmm. and who is a great advocate of universal human rights mm-hmm. and of education as being. Seven out of education, which those of us from a literature background appreciate, and would teach Great Expectations of Dickens and Hard Times, but also concepts of human rights, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. And so I'm just wondering how you draw the line. And within the university, also going back to the Middle Ages, even among as you know, I'm sure, scholastic philosophers, one could debate the existence of God and argue against within that context of the campus, in some sense, mm-hmm. and back to ancient Greece. So I'm just wondering about the limitations of those rights, which might not, mm-hmm. in your definition, part of academic freedom. I also have two questions, because I have Google, mm-hmm. Heracles Lewis.
It's a dangerous thing to do, yeah, yeah.
And yes, it sure does pop up negative. Yeah. And two of the statements in there, mm-hmm. I'd just like to ask you to verify. Mm-hmm. So in one of them it says, is it true, as reported in the media, that Yale has accepted Singapore's right to expel any professor without cause.
No, that's totally not true.
To renew his or her yearly workload.
No, that is not true.
Can the government of Singapore do this?
Well, I suppose the government of Singapore could not renew a work permit, but work permits aren't issued yearly. I don't see that happening, and under our agreements covering academic freedom, I think that would be a violation of our agreements covering academic freedom.
Okay. And the other one is it true that anywhere Singapore campus, both students and faculty, I think this was covered, will be subject to Singapore's strict defamation laws, which forbid criticism of political leaders or government policies, punishments for which include expulsion, imprisonment, and or ostracism without due process?
So I want to go back to the first question. The second question, I'll say, the defamation laws are, and libel laws are very strict in Singapore. They won't apply to campus speech, but yes, you know, when it comes to publications and so on, you're operating under Singaporean law, so it's a different legal environment for what you can say about a government official than what we're used to in Canada or the United States. That exists there, and, you know, that's a law that we have to live with. But to your first point, I think I may not have been clear enough. I'm not arguing for a strong distinction between academic freedom and political freedom. I've been trying to say, maybe not clearly enough, that academic freedom and political freedom are very closely linked, and that the challenge is that in a place where you're perfectly happy with your political freedoms, if there is such a place, then they may be totally coextensive. In a place where political freedoms are more limited in the ways that you're talking about, then academic freedom has the potential to carve out additional freedoms, not lesser freedoms, that are in place, for example, in a campus or in a you know, a classroom or in a research paper and so on. I'll also say about the criticisms of government, it tends to be the case that the more academic the publication, the more openly people criticize Singaporean law and government. It tends to deal with to be under the popular press that the problems that you're talking about mostly arise.
So you seem to endorse the idea that there are different values in Singapore. People must
have I don't think I'm endorsing any particular values in Singapore. I'm saying that when we engage in with a different country that has its own laws, we're very carefully saying these are the freedoms that are necessary for us to pursue the educational venture of creating a liberal arts college. We would not go there if we didn't feel that there were freedoms, that those freedoms were well guaranteed by our arrangements with Singapore. That does not mean that I approve of every law in Singapore, nor for that matter does my 22 years of residence in the United States imply such approval of American laws, or my presence here in Canada imply that I approve yours.
And I'm just curious to know if this choice is related to the fact that you have such a long history in China.
Yeah. But they even at some level weathered the Cultural Revolution. I mean, they were out for a little while. But they in fact founded a Yale College China. We say that this is the first Yale venture with the Yale name in 300 years, but in reality there was a Yale College China that granted degrees, and there's a Yali Middle School that still has an exchange with my kids' middle school. It was founded by, wonderful place. Yale has a long history in China, also in Southeast Asia. There are some great scholarship of Southeast Asia that came out of Yale and important institutes in Singapore that have been founded by Yale. I think there are certain advantages to Singapore as a location. This is pandering, but when people list where are the great public schools, they say Finland, Canada, and Singapore. Actually, not in that order. They usually say Singapore, Finland, and Canada. The education is in English, and Singapore there's good access for people from India, from China, and from the entire region of Southeast Asia, and we're able to serve an international population there, also from Australia. So those are some of the attractions, and obviously Singapore was interested in investing in this, so this is a case where this is a true partnership. It's not some branch that we're creating, but it's something we're jointly working on together with the Singaporeans. Thanks for the question.
Thanks for your talk. I have one question in the form of a disagreement, and
sure.
The other I don't understand how it works.
Sure.
So the disagreement is, whenever I hear these talks about freedom, somebody always comes up and says, well, of course we don't mean professors proselytizing.
Right.
We're going out far outside their expertise in the classroom. It sounds so reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And I can think of examples where it does sound reasonable, but my position is we should tolerate that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was an undergraduate, the guy who first, the first person ever to comb frogs, I took mm-hmm. a class from him. And we get lectures on the political system in Cuba and stuff that did not mean anything. And it was kind of annoying. But for me, that was bad teaching. That wasn't.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me that oftentimes we can back into controversy just as easily.
Mm-hmm.
And so, by virtue of the topic we teach, there will be people saying, you should not be allowed to say that. That is
like evolution. Like evolution, for example, in the case of the frogs.
Right, I think your campus could very quickly run into this with gay and lesbian mm-hmm. studies, but it could also happen just as easily in medicine or in sciences mm-hmm. or any other field. I guess because there is no question there, fundamental disagreement. If you're going to draw the line, who determines what is legitimate and not legitimate?
I, I obviously thought that my speech was clearer than it is. I don't think there's a fundamental disagreement. I did say I agree with Fish to the extent that I don't think people should be handing out political leaflets on campus. I mean, not on campus, but in their classrooms or trying to sign people up for a particular political campaign. But essentially, I think you're probably right, that this is mainly a matter of, like, are you doing a good job teaching more than it is a matter of academic freedom. There are obviously borderline cases, and, you know, we could get into them. In the case of LGBT studies, you know, National University of Singapore already offers a number of courses on LGBT studies. I looked into them a whole lot before I got into this job, and we have a number of faculty who teach everything from sort of queer theory in China and how it relates to Marxism to HIV and public health. And so I don't think that's going to be any problem at all in our context. So go ahead. Sorry, you're saying...
Yeah. The most obvious example. So the only question is about the money.
Yeah.
Right? All of these, you use the word venture.
Yeah.
And these are economic ventures. Right?
Yeah.
There's no money in it. You know, they don't want to be in any one. There's obviously an economic interest and an economic relationship. And so, I mean, there's the idealistic question, which is if Singapore wants to build a world-class liberal arts college, why don't they just make a new one?
Yeah.
And then there's the question, where, if Yale is getting money out of it, where is the money going to go? What's it going to support? Yeah. What educational good will come out of the economic venture if our goal is to support academic freedom and inquiry and all this? And, you know, is it just a cash grab for Yale Corporation?
No.
What's the money going to go?
Yeah, no. In fact, Yale is not getting any money in the sense of, you know, some big hunk of cash or something like that. What Singapore is paying for is a small office in New Haven that coordinates the affairs of the ALNUS College from a New Haven point of view, and it's paying for the campus and operations in Singapore. So it's not like Yale is selling its name. It is a venture, an economic venture, in the sense that if Yale wanted to start its own campus in Singapore, it would have to come up with a whole lot of money, you know, without any cooperation with anybody, it would have to come up with a whole lot of money to build the buildings and hire the faculty and so on. And Singapore is providing that money. So the question is that to the benefit of Yale? There are some people who think this is, I'm going to prove Kerry right when it comes to the neoliberalism, but that this is the dilution of the brand, or that you're selling or exporting or whatever. I prefer to see it, neoliberal though this might sound, as an extension of the brand, in the sense that what Yale is doing is taking the leadership it already has in liberal arts education in North America and making this available in Asia. In a way that it hasn't before. There's a limit to the number of people that we can educate in New Haven. We turn away 92% of the applicants to the undergraduate class. I think part of our role as a leading institution, you know, in previous centuries, former Yale faculty and graduates founded Princeton University, Williams College, and a whole bunch of other liberal arts colleges around the United States. I think that was a good activity for Yale to encourage, and I think it's a good activity for Yale to encourage now, which is the spread of a model of education that we happen to be good at, that other people want, and that we can't supply to the whole world right alone right there in New Haven, so we're supplying it in another way. I think that's a valuable venture or enterprise, even if it does involve words that sound like business. Sure. Well, I mentioned the excellent public education system in Singapore. So the number of very, very highly qualified Singaporeans that we turn away from Yale is also very high. In fact, there just aren't enough spaces in all the major universities of North America for all the highly qualified Singaporeans at a reasonable price. I mean, Yale has full financial aid for international students. There are places that will just, you know, give you a place for $50,000 a year or whatever, but if you're trying to serve the whole diversity of students in Asia, then, you know, you want to be able to do it affordably. Singapore, you know, it's wealthier than those other countries, and so there's enough infrastructure and so on and demand to make this possible. English is the language of instruction. It's a very open country in terms of the coming and going of students, so that makes it possible for us to have a very international faculty, very international student body. So those are all factors there. Thanks.
I'm a little surprised that this is the keynote of a conference about what is academic freedom to do. I would have thought it was more of a keynote speaker conference that might be entitled Shooting the Extended Video Grant elsewhere. I mean, I think the guy was injured is the keynote speech the keynote speech at the conference, what should academic freedom do? Rather than exporting liberal arts, we are importing the limitations of democracy, of the Singaporean model. And I wonder, you know, given that this is the concept of what should academic freedom be, do you think we should export the limitations of the Singaporean model under our definition of academic freedom?
No. I think that your definition of academic freedom should be appropriate for a mature liberal democracy such as Canada. I mean, one of Fish's earlier books had to do with there's no such thing as free speech, and it's a good thing too, if I remember the title correctly, which I didn't agree with either. But there are obviously differences, like speech codes and what's considered okay to talk about in Germany, Holocaust denial, and all of that kind of thing. Those are very interesting questions about academic freedom. I was just asked to speak about my experience, and I'm not an expert on those fields, so I apologize for that.
Other questions? There are two people who want to speak for the second time. Does anyone want to come in and respond to who hasn't spoken?
So, yeah, a question for you, which is really a clarification of the issue that John has raised. In 2007, the AAPP issued a policy statement called Freedom in the Classroom. I don't recommend going to our website and the university search page on the platform.
Much more detail in the classroom.
was a comment, which I didn't
I mean, it sounds more or less right to me. I mean, I'm sorry that I haven't read the document, so I can't comment in a lot of detail, but Fish makes an effort to separate himself from Horwitz, but you're right that he's awfully close, and it does seem far too restricted a notion of academic freedom to me.
Well, just a quick comment on the the relevance of your presence here, because I think it is very relevant that people here can confirm it or not, because I understand that Guild is in the process of exploring or setting up, if not satellite campuses, satellite entities in Qatar and Saudi Arabia. I wonder if you would have any advice for people undertaking such
projects. Well, I'm not familiar with those particular, I mean, I've heard a little bit about them, but I don't know enough to give detailed advice. But I think the last few items on my slide, which unfortunately, I'm not sure if I can get it, oh, there, would be the ones that I would pay attention to in going forward. That is to say, the point about academic freedom and political freedom was not to say there's a sharp distinction between academic freedom and political freedom, but that they're closely related and you have to look at the political freedoms and how will academic freedom function in the context of the particular political freedoms in such a setting. You have to recognize the validity of diverse views. If you go into a setting where you're not sure about the guarantees of academic freedom that already exist in the culture, you should be negotiating strong guarantees before you go in. Once you open the campus, you should create a climate of free inquiry. The respect for cultural differences, I've been, you know, some people have said, oh, you just use respect for cultural differences as an excuse for apologizing for, you know, Singapore or whatever. I think that's too simplistic. I think there are cultural differences, and if you talk to people, I mean, it's what Freud called the narcissism of minor differences, but I'm going to go back to Canada and the United States, right? Like, you discover that the political culture in the United States is rather different than the political culture in Canada, and does that mean that all the Americans are, you know, tyrants or that all the Canadians are Tories or whatever, you know? It's more complicated than that. So I think it has to be done at a level of respect. You can't go into a society and say, we know what's good for you. I think engagement has value, and I think that ultimately, I don't know about highly technical forms of education, but in a broad sense, I think that education is about expansion of freedom. So I think those are the principles I would use in thinking about it.
Everyone is invited for some wine, a little bit of dirt, and everyone is invited to attend the conference on academic freedom tomorrow, which begins at noon and runs from noon to 6. And I think people are welcome to come in and out if that's please join me in thanking Kirk Chris Lewis for
thank you. And lest anyone think that I was just abridging my own academic freedom by deleting my talk, this is somebody else's computer. So if you want the slides, I'm happy to send them to you. I just didn't want to be rude and leave my slides on somebody else's computer. Thanks very much.
Marvelous talk.
Thank you.
And you really